It's the Burt Cohen Show. A lot of fire. That was the excitement that people felt, just about 4 years ago when a young, new candidate, Barack Obama, was running for president and he invoked hope. It was all about hope. It was, frankly, marketing hope. And people threw their emotions into it. And there's been some, disappointment. You know, you could see it coming at the time that Barack Obama raised hopes so high, how could there not be disappointment? And one of the things that people have been kind of disappointed with President Obama in is, showing some backbone, some vertebrae, some, standing up. Our guest today opines that that has changed, that there are some reasons to believe that President Obama is showing some backbone barely in time for the upcoming election, and that there is a lot else going on, that the Republicans are not without a clue. They have some tricks up their sleeve. It's certainly not Mitt Romney, but it isn't over yet by a long shot. Burt Cohen here, a guest today. I'm very pleased to have with us Stephen Rosenfeld. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Glad to be here.
Well, Steve Rosenfeld is a senior fellow covering democracy issues, and he's a longtime print and broadcast journalist and has reported for National Public Radio, Monitor Radio, Marketplace, Alternate, TomPaine.com, and many newspapers. He's written and co-authored three books on voting rights since 2004, including Count My Vote. Well, let's talk about voter suppression as we go along here. But first, I do want to focus on why you think it was perceived that Barack Obama's backbone was kind of soft, and why, what reason do you have to believe that that's starting to change now?
Well, notwithstanding the events of the last, couple of days and couple of weeks where the Romney campaign seems to be imploding before our very eyes, which actually, takes the focus away from Obama, of course. Obviously Obama was elected with, he was a giant movie screen upon which everybody was projecting all kinds of agendas and, their hopes and dreams, especially amongst the center left and the further left. And, there were a lot of things that people expected him to do. I think he doesn't necessarily get credit for a bunch of things. In some areas, he's absolutely continued the Bush-Cheney policies, especially on national security, civil liberties. You could argue he even went further.
Yes.
To give the president more power. That's been very upsetting to a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that, people have generally come to know about him, and this has led to a lot of the disappointment, is that, his mode of being an executive tends to be more of a mediator. He was trying to bring people together. He was trying to find a compromise. He was trying to, it's almost like he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review again. And what's happened over the last couple of years, and I think we saw this most with his convention speech, is that he's realized that that you have to make decisions and you can't negotiate some of the time with people. And I think what we saw in the convention speech, and I know this has mostly been forgotten by now by folks, is that he was taking a harder line. He was being less compromising. And I think that, all those kinds of things, is sort of why I was, sort of saying he is showing more backbone. I think he even said it in the speech, the office has changed him.
Mm.
And that being the case, I think that you know, that's, I think he's learned that he has to, draw some firmer lines. And it's not just on military matters or foreign policy, but it's also with, you know, what he's going to negotiate with and what he's not going to negotiate with, you know, with the Republicans when it comes to entitlement reforms, healthcare reform, things like that.
Well, of course, it does strike me as being in keeping with his famous 2004 speech at the Democratic Convention in Boston, where what grabbed people is he was saying there's not a blue America and a red America, there's just an America. And that hope that was projected back then was that he could be a conciliator and bring the two sides together. And he's, I think, tried to do that over and over and over again. And it appears that that's largely failed, and that it certainly is. What he was talking about being, as you say, a reconciler, bringing people together, was a far cry from Theodore Roosevelt, who said it was a bully pulpit. You have to be strong. Go ahead.
Well, that's true. I think that there are times to draw. You know, it's the whole situation over Libya is a really good example of this.
Yeah.
You know, there are times when a president needs to sort of pound his fist, and there are other times when he needs to show some restraint and some control. And it's, I don't think it's necessarily an ironclad rule, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, Obama has, you know, sort of come to realize that and kind of show us some of that. And what do you think?
Well, I wonder what made him do it. I mean, I was disappointed, certainly, with the big victory was the health care, the Affordable Care Act, that it appeared to me he came to the table compromising. I mean, he was ready to compromise from day one. I always thought, you know, as a former legislator, you start out fighting for what you believe in, and then you compromise. Now, it's true, they got something passed, and it's the first, reality to address this issue that's been worked on for 60, 70 years. He got a little something out of it. But that was, it didn't seem to me a great place to start. And, you know, now a lot of people, the Republicans, and the race is not over yet, the Republicans are saying, well, you know, how's that hopey-changey thing going for you? They don't say, of course, that it's been the Republicans who have blocked him at every turn. But then again, his approach has not been to fight for much.
Well, I think that I think you're right. I think, you know, I think after, you know, this week's news, which, you know, I mean, Romney's had two terrible weeks. You know, last week he kind of blew it on Libya because he just really miscalculated that you don't attack the president and the State Department while American interests are being attacked abroad.
Right.
And, you know, and the latest with these videos coming out showing him to be, you know, like a very crass, you know, class warrior looking down at most
middle-income
Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's going to happen is that, you know, the race is going to return to, you know, essentially a fight for the middle class. I mean, it, implicit in Romney's criticism that 47% of the people, you know, are freeloaders. And, of course, he thinks those 47% are only Democrats, as if no one in a red state, and most of the landlocked red states are the ones that take, they import more federal money than they export in taxes.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, it's going to return to a fight for the middle class. And that's what Obama did at the convention. He really tried to frame the race as a fight for the middle class. You know, he says, you know, we're not going to cut taxes for the people who are making more than $250,000 a year. We're going to cut them for people who need it. He's been saying, I mean, the thing about the economic recovery is, it's really easy to blame government for not fixing it, but they didn't create it. They created the regulatory conditions that allowed the banks to go off the rails and create the whole housing boom. But they didn't create the greed and, you know, the stock trades and the financial instruments that, you know, 4 years ago brought down Lehman Brothers and then caused all the credit crunch and all that. So I think what's happening is, you know, it looks to me like Obama's kind of gotten the message that he's done a crummy job, you know, maintaining his base and standing up for it. And even though there's a lot of stuff he's done that, quite frankly, is disappointing to the left.
Yes.
You know, personally, some of the stuff he's done is disappointing to me. But I think, you know, as a journalist and a reporter, and I have covered presidential campaigns since 1992, you know, I see him up there with more resolve, less compromise, and I think, you know, and I think that that's, you know, a more positive development.
Interesting.
I'm also, like, you know, hopey and, you know, and, you know, just all hope and good cheer.
Well, I'm reminded of when, back in the early 70s when I was doing some substitute teaching, as you were describing it, I went in there, you know, trying to work with the kids and not be the tough guy. And then I found, after being there a while, ooh, I had to lay down the law and get a little tougher. Well, it works better if you start out tough. And then
I agree with that. And, you know, and listen, we could talk about the Affordable Care Act. There's, you know, most people don't even really know what's in it.
For sure.
It's a little complicated.
Yes.
But actually, maybe complicated is not the right word. Maybe it's just
it's
that
complex.
It's complex because
yes.
It does so many different things that have more or less been, from my perspective, have been good health policy ideas.
Yeah.
Like creating clinics in rural and underserved areas. You know, the big problem with it, of course, which everyone pays attention to, is, you know, the central compromise in it, which, you know, Obama needed to raise the money needed to have the money that could be redistributed for these, you know, these public programs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, people like me, who are often self-employed, over the years, will have to, you know, pay for a policy where there are no price controls. You know, and that's what, you know, that's when you say he didn't come to the table with a harder line. Well, yeah, he came to the table, like, accepting that as a foregone conclusion, which, personally, which he didn't.
Yeah.
Because that's an expensive proposition, on a personal side for someone like me. But from the policy side or the more political side, you know, he's created the greatest prospect of expanding public care options that we've seen in a long, long time. And none of this stuff, you know, just mushrooms overnight. It takes time to develop. And let's just hope that, you know, it can actually move towards more, you know, public options without bureaucracies, you know, adding their 15% in between.
Yeah, it was interesting in 2010 when the Democrats got squashed like bugs or whatever. I was speaking to someone who said she was going to vote against the local candidate for Congress because of the health care thing. I spoke with this woman for a while, and she said she really wanted basically single-payer expanded Medicare. And, you know, the Republicans, it's so easy for them to spin the Affordable Care Act as saying, big government coming down on you. That's easy to understand. And it was much more difficult for Democrats to come back after compromising. I wonder how risk-averse Barack Obama is, kind of by his nature. And
I think he is. I think he's learned that he has to take more risks. You know, it's really interesting. I was on the I went to a lot of rallies on the 2008 campaign, and I saw Hillary speak a lot, and I saw Obama speak a lot. And I thought Obama was vague, and I thought that Hillary was really specific, and I thought she gave better speeches. And then I spoke to this one guy who said to me, you know, they have two different management styles. Hillary was sort of like, you know, you win, you rule, you know where the levers of power are, and you turn them.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama was more of a mediator. And, you know, that's where I mentioned the mediation thing before, where and more of like a consensus builder.
Right.
And that's, you know, where I think his nature came from. And at the time, I personally voted for him. And I thought, well, you know, after 8 years of George W. Bush, where, you know, he won, he ruled, nobody could do anything about it, he took us to war, blah,
right.
blah, blah.
He was a decider.
You know, it was interesting. It was worth taking a bet on somebody who had a different management style.
Hmm.
But, you know, but there are times you can't negotiate with thugs. And this Republican Congress has behaved like thugs
yes.
more of the time. They're completely obstructionist. And you know, and the president, therefore, needs to have more backbone. And I think he's learned over time, you know, despite his, you know, earlier inclinations, that he, you know, how to actually have some of that.
We are talking with Stephen Rosenfeld, senior fellow covering democracy issues Been with a reporter for a lot of different radio and print media talking about the president finding a backbone. And later on, I'm going to get to voter suppression as well. And part of the backbone issue really is, well, it's about money. There may be the 99%, but the 1% have the money. And it, obviously it costs a tremendous amount of money to run for president. It's just unbelievable amounts of money. And I wonder how, you know, Democrats have frankly served the corporate interests, as well as Republicans, and, you know, just happily done so. So I wonder, you know, does Obama get the sense now, Stephen, that maybe now is a good time to talk about financial regulations and reining in the guys that caused the problem? He hasn't really done that so far. I haven't heard him talking about much. It's a little bit risky to look like maybe he's going with the Occupy people. In fact, it's a lot risky to do that. What's your sense of what his strategy is now with regard to the us versus them, the class war, the Wall Street versus everybody else?
Well, you know, I was personally happy to see, you know, what people would label some of the class warfare language during the Democratic convention. Whether it wasn't so much him, it was more Biden. It was more what's her name running for Massachusetts?
Elizabeth Warren. That was a great
Warren,
speech.
Elizabeth
yes.
Warren, particularly.
Yeah, yeah.
I was very happy to see, you know, the president of the, you know, UAW. I think it was UAW up there, and some of the other people who were at the companies, you know, that they lost their jobs because of Bain.
Right.
And I think actually that, you know, with Romney's latest statement that 40% of Americans, you know, are going to vote for Obama because they're on the federal dole and they're just laggards and parasites. And, it's going to, I think it's a discussion worth having, because I think that, we have, extraordinary income disparities. You know, it's really hard to get to change your rung or place on the economic ladder unless you're super lucky most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that, you know, when you, I think it's one thing to talk about it on the campaign trail or to be at an Occupy rally and say that corporations are not people, and it's another thing to actually get into office and change the laws, and more than that, just change the institutions that actually, allow, the business of business and the business of government, you know, to go as they go on day by day and week by week. You know, so after the Wall Street crash, you know, everybody who, you know, a lot of people who are in Wall Street who were supporting Obama in 2008 mm-hmm. said he's no longer our guy. We're not going to give him any money. The Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill comes along, and so it gets through the Congress. And what happens? It's bogged down in the rulemaking process. Now, talk about stuff that makes the public glaze over.
Yeah.
You know, just because you have a law doesn't mean that it takes effect. You have to actually write the fine print and the rules. And the people on Wall Street who sort of brought us this crisis, they don't want any regulation. They want the freedom to, you know, to just make as much money as they can. And if they goof up, well, that's, you know, the,
we got to pay for it.
Be damned. And I think that, you know, Obama, gosh, could he be stronger on that stuff? Yeah, I think he could be stronger on that stuff. This is the stuff that's a little deflating. You just wish he would do more, because it seems like the outrages and the problems are just so clear. But
just in terms of electoral strategy, I mean, you and I might like him to do a heck of a lot more to rein in Wall Street, because that's what we believe. But in terms of electoral strategy, every now and then the president has sort of hinted at some of this, you know, we have to rein in Wall Street and, you know, sentiments like that, but not very often. And you know, you look at the electorate and what's going on. Is it good electoral strategy for him to look like he's showing backbone against Wall Street? You know, simple as that.
I just think it would be in this current climate, because, the thing is, if you, this gets a little nerdy, but, you know, American history is never quite the same, but there are a lot of patterns that repeat themselves. And I think it's very instructive to take a look at the 1930s and look at what Franklin Roosevelt went through. And, I mean, you know, the Supreme Court today is no more reactionary than it was when Franklin Roosevelt was president, and they tried to block the New Deal.
Right, they sure did.
So you know, so you have these justices who are like create this, you know, who deregulate money and political campaigns, and it gives us, you know, the campaign we have right now. And they do other things too that grant all kinds of rights to the business community while shrinking rights, you know, for individuals. And you know, that's really disturbing. And I think that you know, I actually hope in kind of a secret way, not a secret way, talking radio, that you know, Romney's crazy but honest comments about the 47% being, you know, freeloaders on the government. I mean, you know, maybe it will bring this into sharper relief, because really we ought to be talking about the role of government and the role of business and the role of other, you know, civic institutions. You know, it's not like anyone has all the solutions or creates all the problems.
Right.
So, you know, I hope that might become the case. And I hope that actually, if it is the case, there would be a clearer mandate to lead in a way that is not so squishy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of a debate within the Democratic Party. There are the Democratic Leadership Council people, the you know, position that Bill Clinton certainly was in, you know, to be somewhat to the right. But then there's the what Paul Wellstone called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And my old friend Bob Borisov says that he believes that passion attracts, cautious positioning alienates. And that's kind of a split within the Democratic Party. And there, and here we have Barack Obama as the head of the Democratic Party. And it seems like he might be kind of straddling those two, if that's at all possible. Or what do you see with regard to those two very clear factions within the Democratic Party?
Well, I think he is straddling the two. And I think that, you know, that it leads to frustration to all involved.
Hmm.
I mean, but you compare it to the Republican Party, where, you know, I mean, right now we're seeing them with their, you know, the circular firing squads, you know, like, you know, lining up and shooting at each other.
Yes.
I mean, it's just extraordinary. And I think that the Democrats showed a whole lot more discipline and unity and focus, actually, at their convention compared to the Republicans. And you're seeing it now. I mean, in the last week, we've seen the most extraordinary display by Republican pundits, like, you know, the big ones, you know, Rush Limbaugh, you know, Laura Ingraham, other people like that, basically saying, you know, this party is doomed if they can't beat Obama, right? You know, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen, at least, you know, this week. And we have several weeks to go, obviously. And but, you know, I do think that it's going to be very telling. And it's not just, you know, depending what happens in Congress.
Right.
Obama could win, but if the Congress stays in Republican hands,
I know,
then we have the same stalemate that we've had for years. And so it's very, very, you know, it's frustrating. And I do think, by the way, that the Republicans are going to take more desperate measures, because these are desperate times for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're going to do everything they can to try to, you know, tilt the field and discourage likely Democratic voters and
yes,
lawyer up when it comes to counts, close, sort of disqualified ballots. And, you know, I mean, this is part of, you know, their vocabulary of tactics.
Well, before we get to voter suppression, which does lead nicely into, I'm remembering the styles, as you mentioned, of Franklin Roosevelt and one of our greatest Democratic presidents, Lyndon Johnson, who, if not for the Vietnam War, which was fairly big, would have been considered one of the great presidents. He was tough. He stood up to members of Congress. He did what was called the treatment on them. Obama is a far cry from that. And being conciliator, I don't know. You know, it's the debate goes on. You know, should the...
Yeah, I know. I know the debate goes on. And believe me, you know, I write at Alternate. And if I write these pieces saying Obama's showing some spine, people write these letters saying, or these comments saying, you know, I'm a sellout, I'm an Obama bot, I'm a this, I'm a that. I mean, you know, we just, you know, we're sort of stuck with the choice we have, and we could hope for the best and try to make it better. I mean, you know, compared to Romney, I mean, what kind of a choice is there? I mean, everybody has their personal reasons to vote or not vote. For me, I'm really concerned about who appoints the next Supreme Court justice.
Amen.
because I'm in my early 50s, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life with a bunch of, you know, rabid Republicans destroying, you know, the public sector, you know, and privatizing entitlements and things like that, just because they've already got their millions in the bank. And, you know, so, you know, that's a personal reason for me. And I can, and listen, Obama has not been so great with appointing, you know, wonderfully progressive judges to the federal bench.
And it's also true, as you mentioned early on, in terms of civil liberties, my goodness, Nixon looks like a liberal. You know, this.
Well, he was a liberal. He created the Environmental Protection
Agency. He did.
But, I mean, he was, you know, I actually have a lot. I spent, you know, 20 years after college living in Vermont, where there was a certain type of liberal Republican that I actually respect a lot.
They're George Aiken.
Conservative.
Right.
And they're socially liberal.
Yep.
And you know that they're not an endangered species; they've vanished.
That's true. They're just about extinct, really. And here on the other side of the border, to the right of Vermont, quite literally, the House of Representatives. If any Republican dares even speak to a Democrat, he or she gets oftentimes stripped of their committee assignments. It's absolutely amazing. You're right. The moderates, the open-minded people, as I mentioned, you know, George Aiken was one of the great old Vermont U.S. senators. He was the guy who declared with regard to Vietnam, we should just say we won and get out. That was back in
19... Jim Jeffords.
Jim Jeffords.
Jim Jeffords was a federal prosecutor, you know, state attorney general. He never was governor. You know, he was congressperson, then he was a senator. He left the Republican Party. Remember, he left it and he caused them to lose their Senate majority?
Yes, that was wonderful.
Because he said they were, like, too extreme for him?
Well, and they've gotten a lot more extreme since then. It's amazing. But, you know, right now, it seems like there's the Democrats who know they're going to vote. There's the Republicans who know they're going to vote. Well, maybe some of those are whittling away, too. But, you know, it's this very few percentage in between of undecideds. And that's where the battle is within these, what, six states. And going after the undeclares, the independents, you know, and I know that the middle class, the fight for the middle class, seems to be important, and a lot of people, even in the lower income ranges, often identify with people like Romney. We had our Craig Benson here, who was actually wealthier than Romney, which is amazing. But that they often identify with that. I wonder if Obama is recognizing that somehow framing the race as a fight for the middle class can help him. It seems like he's stepping up to that. And I got to go back to, you know, the choice really is between, I mean, people may have called you a sellout. They may call me that too, because, you know, it's not just the lesser of two evils. Things are possible with Obama. They are not possible with Romney. And if you vote for a Nader or somebody like that, you're voting for Romney. Let's face it. I mean, it's just no question about that. You have to do that way. But getting back to the middle class, those independents, is Obama moving in the right direction, do you think, to catch that those small percentage of people that are undecided? And
well,
go ahead.
You know, it's interesting. I looked at some polling from last week because I was doing some research for a story. It's approximately 9%. You know, a national poll by John Zogby, Jay-Z Analytics, 9% are undecided. 2% go for, like, the Green. 2% go for the Libertarian. You know, 1% goes for the Constitution Party guy. You know, it turns out that 9% are undecided. Well, 50% of those who are undecided say they make less than $50,000 a year. It's beyond, I just cannot believe that any of those folks would believe that Romney is going to help them. Now, you know, I could be wrong because, you know, I don't listen to talk radio in Ohio, you know, or right. or rural Virginia.
Right.
And, I haven't had it drummed into my head that the president isn't a U.S. citizen. He's a Muslim in disguise and all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know,
well, I can
actually think that, you know, I think that he's not shying away from drawing out these distinctions. And I think they're good distinctions to draw out. I mean, for example, you know, he's going to talk about that, you know, they have to deal with it, you know, with the tax cuts before the end of the year, the whole debt thing. And he has to, you know, and they're attacking him for, you know, for pulling back, you know, the INF and immigration enforcement, you know, for people who are, you know, the sons of illegal immigrants, right, who are in schools that are doing well.
That are really Americans.
You know, I think these are good fights. And I think that he's taking the right position on these fights, you know, and I think that, you know, I also think that with foreign policy coming into this, you know, I think I've said all along that there's going to be these moments. We saw one last week where there's going to be some unplanned crisis, and you're going to see who's a steadier hand on the wheel, if you will. And I think that, you know, Obama showed that he was steadier with Libya. I think that, you know, I think he's showing that he's steadier, that he's not knuckling down to the Israeli, you know, prime minister, mm-hmm, who's basically trying to get us to, like, you know, commit to bombing Iran.
I know.
I mean, you know, I think these kinds of things matter. You know, I think talking about trying to, you know, reduce the student loan interest rates, you know, matters.
That does matter.
And I just hope that people, I just hope that people turn out and vote, because, you know, all this, a strong turnout basically washes away like a tidal wave all the lawyering and fighting and nitpicking and, you know, the sort of last line of legal defense, which kind of resulted in, you know, the Florida recount that brought us, you know, George W. Bush and not Al Gore. And I, you know, we have a couple weeks left for voter registration in the swing states. And I just hope that people don't get intimidated, don't think they're, you know, they're going to be police at the polls, you know, and register and have the right kind of ID and just realize that, you know, yeah, this stuff does matter. And you know, there is more than there's a lot of differences between these guys and these parties. And, you know, I think it's naive for people to say there's not and just stand on some, like, you know, purist principle. Yeah. You've got to vote for the Green, or you got to vote for the Libertarian, or this or that. You know, both of those guys are local elections. But on a national level, you know, let's be realistic. That's what I think.
Well, one of my favorite quotes, and I do have a lot of favorite quotes, is from a friend of mine who was chair of the Finance Committee in the New Hampshire House, and she said, never let the good be the enemy of the perfect. You know, and I think sometimes people do that. We have what we have. It's either going to be Obama or Romney. Let's face it, one of these other guys is not going to win. Does it send a message? I'm not so sure, you know, if you vote for a Green or somebody like that. But you talk about turnout being so important. The Republicans know that. Listen,
the Republicans in Ohio and in Colorado are sending absentee ballot applications. They're the Secretary of State. They are sending, which is the chief election officer in those states.
Mm-hmm.
They're sending absentee ballot applications to every registered voter in the state. It is completely legal for them to fill out those applications for people and essentially knock on the door and say, will you please sign this? It's also completely legal for them, you know, to bring, you know, to knock on people's doors and say, well, have you mailed in your absentee ballot yet? And let me hand you a little postcard with a list of who you should vote for, or just vote a straight party ticket. You know, this kind of stuff is how, you know, elections end up getting won, and not necessarily on election day, the Tuesday, that is. You know, we have an election season. We have early voting in some states. We have absentee ballots that come in by mail after the first Tuesday in November.
Right.
And, you know, they know this stuff. And they know it well. And they also know that, you know, all these voter ID laws and things like that, they're designed to impede polling place voting. And, you know, that's where last-minute impulse voters go. That's where, in the cities, people who don't have cars, they go to polling places. That's where students go. You know, the Republican base is more suburban. It's more middle class. It votes by mail in those states where there's an option more. You know, and this, you know, this stuff, they know this stuff. There's nothing new about this whatsoever. And,
well, they're just getting...
You know, and in some states, it could come down to this. I really hope it doesn't. Because if there's a difference of less than 5,000 votes, it's going to be so, so ugly, and it's going to make Florida seem like child's play.
We are talking with Stephen Rosenfeld, Bert Cohen here. We're talking about democracy, voting, the president having a backbone at last. on this voter suppression stuff, it does seem quite clear that they did learn a lot from Florida. And I believe it appears that virtually every state in the nation has some sort of voter suppression laws that have been passed recently. They know exactly what they're talking about. They know that, you know, a lot of black people in the cities don't have cars. They don't have photo ID. And there was a protest sign at this year's primary saying voter ID is 21st century Jim Crow. And it's focused on students as well.
You know, the thing about voter ID is that, I mean, we should be clear about a couple things here. First, when you fill out a voter registration form, you sign an oath under penalty of perjury that your information is true and not fraudulent. So if you are, in fact, lying, you're signing your confession if the cops want to prosecute. The second thing is that most states have had all kinds of ID requirements for years, but they're not one specific form of plastic with one type of photograph issued within a certain time period from a specific government agency that requires you to pay money or show other documents. And that's where it gets really nefarious. That's where it gets kind of, you know, purposely, you know, deceptive and kind of ugly. That's how the suppression stuff works. The public nationally supports the idea of photo ID laws because most people think, well, I got to show one to get on a plane or this or that and the other. The evil or dark, quote, genius, unquote, of the Republican voter ID strategy is that it is narrowing the field of, it's creating yet another eligibility hurdle. To be a registered voter, you have to be a citizen of a certain age, a legal resident, mentally sound, which means you're not judged by a court to be incapacitated, not a felon, or you've regained your rights to vote, and then you get a ballot. And the thing is, they've added another category, which is you have to have the right kind of plastic in your pocket.
Hmm.
Now, it used to be, and it still is in many states, that you can show a utility bill or a phone bill or some piece of paper. And the state of Wisconsin just passed something where they are allowing you to bring a laptop or an electronic device that has, you know, identifying information on it. But the thing is, in many cities and in many states, people don't drive or they just don't have the birth certificate to get the state issue ID. And it has to be a current ID. You know, it can't be a campus ID that's expired. All this crazy stuff. And that's just one example of how it can complicate the process.
Well, it seems that they intend to complicate the process, to intimidate people from voting. People are concerned. They're a little bit scared to get out and vote, which in a big picture strikes me as really an assault on democracy itself, which I find just astounding because, I mean, democracy is about participating, self-government, you know, citizenry.
Yeah, well, it's nothing new, and it's been this way for years. And the Democrats and Republicans over the decades have had their share of doing this kind of stuff. You could tend to look at it as, instead of saying DNR, you could say the governing classes or the power elite in whatever jurisdiction it happens to be will do whatever it takes to maintain or preserve their power. It just happens that, especially since 2000 in Florida, you know, the Republicans, nationally have been passing or adopting, 95% of these measures. And it's not just voter ID. It's changes in early voting schedules. It's penalties for voter registration drives. It's required trainings for people who will actually go out to register voters. I mean, these things really are affronts to the First Amendment, freedom of assembly, things like that. But the courts aren't. Some courts say that this is ridiculous. Some courts say they're not.
Right.
You know, the judges can be just as political as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And they are. So what you have is you have all that happening. Then you also have, and this is scary to me, the election system is, the equipment side of it is, it's running on the equivalent of 10 and 15-year-old laptops that get stored in cold warehouses, literally, and don't always function as designed. So it's kind of running on rickety machinery. Because you have poll workers or volunteers, you've got this crazy, crazy, slow-motion collision coming where the lawyers will come in and they'll say, oh my, everybody needs to be treated equally under the law, which means that every ballot must be assessed and cast and given and provided for exactly the same way. And that never happens in a system manned by, 2 million poll workers nationally in a presidential election. So it's just one of these things where there's so much for the lawyers to fight about, and they love splitting these hairs. And the only remedy, really, is to have high turnout elections where it doesn't come down to disqualifying votes or adding votes by, several hundred or several thousand, in key counties. And that's kind of what happened in Florida. So U.S. Supreme Court stopped the state administering a recount, saying that different counties were treating ballots differently. Well, welcome to America, local control of elections. That's what it is. Kind of happened that way with the Al Franken and Norm Coleman recount that made him a U.S. senator but kept him from taking office for the first 6 months that Obama was the president, and therefore nothing could get through the Senate. That was a big reason why Obama didn't get more done.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
And all we can say is, hey, folks, a lot of states, if you don't register in the next 2 weeks, you're not going to be able to vote. That's Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Colorado.
And it is intimidating people, and it seems very clear it's intended to intimidate people, intended to intimidate college students in particular, because guess what? They tend to vote Democrat. They tend to be liberal. And black people, too. And the Jim Crow laws back in the 40s and 50s were saying, no, blacks can't vote for one reason or another. Well, this is kind of a 21st century way to do that. At least it appears to me.
It tends to intimidate new voters, regardless of color, who don't know their rights.
Right.
Who don't basically say, screw you, you're not going to stop me from voting. I'm eligible, I'm registered, and I have my ID. It takes a little while to learn any system. And if you're new and you're a college student, or you're like a young mother and you've got to pick up a kid in daycare and, there's not enough voting machines in the place, and you can't wait in line.
And you're not sure they'll let you vote anyway.
One of my professional friends, he was the guy who the Florida Supreme Court put in charge of the presidential recount 2000.
Oh, wow.
For more than 20 years, he's been the election supervisor in the county where the state capital is in Florida. And he says that all the noise there that was created by that state's Tea Party governor, Rick Scott, about having something like 180,000 non-citizens on voter rolls, and there's going to be purges, and there's going to be new IDs, this, that, and the other. Most of that stuff was nothing but political propaganda, threats.
Yes.
He says it's led to his office being inundated with calls by people who are afraid to vote.
Yes.
So more than anything else, they're afraid of doing something wrong. And they're new voters, primarily, or people who don't vote in every single election. That's the strategy. That's how it works. Like you said, it's really, really sad.
And it's really ugly to think that they're okay with that, by suppressing the vote, if they win, it doesn't really matter. We are talking with Stephen Rosenfeld, senior fellow covering democracy issues for Alternet. And one of the things that you've written about is that, well, people on the right are really afraid of Obama, that they're mentioned 7 nightmare scenarios for right-wingers if Obama wins a second term. I had a minister many years ago who said that there was only 2 things that motivate people in politics, fear and reassurance. And it does seem that the Republicans, or T-evangelists, whatever you want to call them, are trying to make people afraid to vote. They're using fear to make people not vote. What are the right-wingers so afraid of if Obama wins a second
term?
Oh,
well, that's so completely clear. Here's the thing. It's really super simple. We don't look like 1950s America anymore, where the majority population, the typical middle-class family, is white and has 2 to 3 kids, and the mother stays at home,
right,
and the father has a job and all that sort of stuff, and everyone has a nice house and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're becoming a more multicultural society.
Right.
And what the Republicans are afraid of is that they lose in that, because if you think about, Latinos, and I'm generalizing here a little bit, and it's not always good to generalize, they tend to be very conservative in many respects.
Yes, social conservative, yes.
Family, hard work.
Right.
You would think in some respects they would be more inclined to vote Republican or support Republicans, people who, the whole Republican thing of we're the people who are the entrepreneurs, which is absurd, but that's their thing. But the thing is, when the Republican Party, like in California, where I am, the state party, governors, demonize illegals and pass, in Arizona, basically pass these laws to to try to encourage self-deportation.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, you can be stopped. This is like, you know, 1930s Europe. You know, where are your papers?
Right.
And so the thing is, they know, the Republican Party and their leadership knows, they are heading into, you know, permanent minority status unless they, and you see this in the redistricting case
in right.
states like Texas. The state of Texas, Texas legislature gained 3 congressional seats since the last census from 2000 to 2010. The way they drew their state and federal congressional district lines was to basically just create these jigsaw puzzle-like pieces to essentially keep, you know, white majority-controlled districts. And they were sued by civil rights groups and the Justice Department, and they lost. And new maps were drawn by the courts because, you know, there are voting rights laws that say you can't dilute representation of minorities.
Mm-hmm.
That's a key part of the Voting Rights Act, which the Republicans are, right, and the next Supreme, and the current Supreme Court, it, you know, they think there's a strong chance that the Roberts Court is going to overturn some of that stuff.
Mm.
And they're pushing for this, just like they're pushing for voter IDs. You know, it's so interesting. Why would a state like Kansas be going crazy over voter ID laws? It's not a presidential swing state. Well, it's because there are a lot of people from Central America and East Africa settling there. It's no longer an all-white state.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Republicans fear is that, you know, America is changing, and it's not changing into what they see in the mirror. And they don't want it to change. You know, people who are in power, they want to keep control. So when you take a look at, like, what the right wing is doing, and this is, you know, a, very much a talk radio thing, they're saying the sky is falling. And they say it in different ways. Like, they're saying, oh, my gosh, Obama is going to drastically reduce nuclear weapons. Oh, my God, he's going to reorient the military towards global solutions, like peacekeeping. Oh, my God. You know, he's going to move us to single-payer health care. He's going to resurrect the New Deal. He's going to grant all these, you know, these young people who are here illegally, you know, Americans, essentially, since they've been in public schools, citizenship. You know, he's going to do stuff like that. And what's that all about? You know, he's going to slap down the oil companies just a little bit so we can have some alternative energy. You know, he's going to make it easier to join unions. He's going to, you know, grant amnesty to, you know, for immigration. He's going to, you know, this is the kind of stuff they say is just un-American. Well, it's laughable because some people may not be for those things, and okay, fine. But the vast majority of Americans are for those kinds of things. They don't want more wars in the, over energy in the Middle East. You know, they think that, you know, young people should be given a fair shot. They think that taxes should be fair. They think there's a role for government to provide an economic and social safety net.
Yes.
I mean, these are studies by Pew and others going back years and years and years. It's not socialism if you are not a pauper in your retirement, but you have like a small, you know, government-funded pension. And to think that unions are strong when it's just absurd. But mostly what this is all about is that, you know, the Republicans are afraid that America is turning into a country that doesn't look like them, where they can't be a majority party.
Mm.
You know, that's what that's all about.
It is so fascinating that what they see in the Republicans, the right wing, seems so afraid of is a lot of things that a lot of people on the left wish Obama actually would do, like creating a new deal. He hasn't done it. I don't see any indication that he will do it, but a lot of people hope, you know, he would have public works jobs to put people to work and to fix our infrastructure. And the Republicans are certainly afraid of that. My sense is that the Republican Party, they know they're not going to win people of color. They're not going to win that. Is it possible, do you think, Steve Rosenfeld, that just getting the angry white males to vote and keeping down others, could that actually turn out to be a key to victory for Mr. Romney?
Well, it's really interesting you say that. Yeah, it depends. It could be a key to victory in a low turnout election.
Right.
And in fact, that's exactly what we saw in 2010 with the so-called Tea Party. You know, the Tea Partiers were essentially, they're approximately 20% of the electorate. They're the hard right. They're the same cohort that voted for Ross Perot going back, you know,
a
number of presidential, you know, campaigns to 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of the same people who supported Richard Nixon, who we called the moral majority. They're primarily white. They're primarily retirees. They're primarily more affluent. They classically say, hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, I know.
While railing against government. And the thing is, they brought us a lot of the these debt-obsessed House members, you know, Rand Paul, you know, and the Libertarian, you know, in the Senate. But, you know, the thing about it is that they're a permanent part of the U.S. domestic political landscape, but they're not a majority. You know, just like someone like might say, like someone like me would be on the liberal fringe. Well, they're on the, you know, they're on the libertarian right wing fringe.
Yeah.
And I think that anger only goes so far. I mean, I think that, you know, people were tired of war and tired of George Bush's sort of my way or the highway approach, and they voted for Obama. I think that people have seen so much anger and frustration, you know, with, you know, just with our domestic politics in the last couple of years, the stalemate. And this is what's so interesting to me, because I just, as Romney is running to the right and he's trying to, you know, reassert social conservative themes and things like that, we're being attacked abroad in this whole crazy, you know, Libya thing and that very, very anti-Islamic film. We're being attacked abroad by people who are incited by extremists. I think at a certain point, people are just, I don't know. You know, well, people, who knows? People are always selfish sometimes, sometimes less so, but I just think that we're at a place in time where, like, more extremism doesn't seem to be solving anything. It's, I just hope that kind of gets through.
It's interesting. That sort of brings us back to the beginning that, you know, a lot of people on the left wishing Obama would stand and fight, and yet Romney is clearly trying to, I think, with his foreign policy gaffes, I'm not so sure they were not intentional to say, we don't care what the hell the world thinks. We're going to do it our way, and you're going to do it our way, whether you like it or not. That has some appeal, but that's, you're right, that's really confrontational.
I talked to a fellow who was a pollster last week. He said the reason Romney's doing all this stuff is he's trying to appeal to senior citizens in Florida and other people who are sort of, you know, more, you know, sort of like identify themselves with the post-World War II generation, people who supported the Vietnam War and things like that, and because he has nowhere else he can run to. You know, he's trying to wave that patriotic flag. It just keeps backfiring. I mean, he keeps saying that Obama is apologizing to the world. This is nothing new. He's been saying that, the Republicans have been saying that for a while. But he says the United States is not in control. Like, you know, we should be in control.
White male domination yet again.
But actually, we kind of are in control in some respects. I mean, I don't know who it was, but, you know, within 36 hours of those, you know, that Libya attack and that killed the four Americans, including the ambassador, the young Libyan government, if you even call it a government, they're arresting people. Now, who knows if they're just rounding up the usual suspects in the movie Casablanca, but it doesn't show that America is not sort of like dictating stuff and driving events in response to what's happening.
The Republicans are certainly playing on fear, trying to keep white Christian males dominant in this, and they could be, who knows? I mean, if the vote were held today, it looks pretty strong, but who the heck knows what's going to happen in between? You can follow Stephen Rosenfeld. Well, what's actually the best way to follow you, on Alternet?
Well, just Alternet. I don't do the greatest job with posting all of my stuff on Twitter and Facebook and everything. Alternet.org, we write a lot of original content, and we're one of a handful of sites that has fairly decent traffic and is, you know, trying to do our own analysis and drive the narratives that we think are important, you know, as we, you know, sort of hurtle towards Election Day.
And we are hurtling fast. Stephen Rosenfeld, thank you so much for being with us. Very informative today. And we'll watch the political dynamics as it goes and see how many millions of dollars each side can spend between now and then.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. And maybe, who knows if winds of change are going to be blowing this way. Again, thanks for listening, and email me, Bert@BertCohen.com.